I would like to zero in on one big picture aspect of what you said, this idea of technocratic fate. There are glimmers here and there of what is arguably a rollback of the Industrial Revolution. There are people who bike rather than drive, and they think they're doing something morally good that way.
Probably are.
There's a movement toward, you know, tiny houses. I don't know who watches home and garden television. Oh, fan base. But they, too, think that they're doing something right by being more organic. In other words, there's not just a feeling that this is, you know, good for your health, but there's a sort of Kantian urgency attached to a growing number of decisions like this. And of course, the most obvious example is food, because you have people who say are carnivores, but who want to be mindful carnivores, and that's why Chipotle can have charge a little more money for chickens that are raised in a certain way and this kind of thing. So the point is this: if, as you say, the sexual revolution is the human face of the technological revolution, and if we see that rollback is possible with the technological revolution, then doesn't that suggest a little happier fate than the one you've described?
Well, a couple of things I should clarify. I use the language of fate to be provocative. I'm not a Hegelian. And so, or Marxist, and so by fate, I don't mean any specific future consequence that follows from the present with deterministic mechanical necessity. And the point is that, but on the same time, you know, when something is introduced into the stream of history, it's done in a way that is very difficult and arguably cannot be undone. I mean, you know, the example that I love to give for this, because we all have to think about it, especially those of us who have children, you know, is these things, right? No one knew they wanted or needed one of these 20 years ago. Didn't imagine it. And it has reshaped all of our lives and created situations without precedent, which as a parent, you have no choice but to respond to, right? It's that kind of determination in a sense that's what I mean. And it determines not only sort of practically how we respond to this, but how we view what things are. That's a very, and part of the point of going to the level of, you know, it shaping what it means for us to think is to say that this is a very, very deep thing. And there are, it seems to me, certain, although we don't know what they are, maybe inevitabilities isn't the right word, but certain consequences that follow from the introductions of these things, which we may or may not be able to do much about. I mean, I don't know where I stand on the climate change hysteria, and whether the models are correct, or B, whether human beings caused it. But if they did, and it's either is possible, but if they did, this is a totally unanticipated consequence of, you know, a couple of centuries of industrialization that no one could have foreseen. And it illustrates the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And it's also likely to be something that, you know, we couldn't engineer a reversal of. So in that kind of sense, you know, that's not a very happy picture. But it seems to me that the possibilities of resisting that or being free within it or initiating genuinely new things depend upon our being able to think differently and to see what generally we don't see, particularly as Christians. I mean, I'm baffled by the way, for instance, that the latest stage of the sexual revolution was conducted almost entirely at the level of a contest of rights without any public awareness of what it means, basically, to create children, I mean, to be able to create children for whom the answer, for whom there is no intelligible answer to the question, who is my mother? You know, that's a remarkable thing, and that's a thing we're not likely to be able to control because we have a whole network of common scientific knowledge, technological know-how. I mean, it is a system of some kind. Our ability to possibly initiate something new and to free ourselves from that depends upon, I think, as I say, and I don't know how to do it all the way to the bottom, but depends upon a recovery of a different kind of thinking, and a recovery of some sense of nature. So I don't want to say that it's hopeless, but the hopelessness does not, you know, it's part of the inevitability of suffering. It seems to me is a crucial dimension of Christian faith that we have tried to circumvent for a long time. And in this, I don't think we're going to be able to circumvent that.
I'm going to kind of pop in on this. I think you're right to use the language of fate. I don't think it's just a provocation. I'm quite struck when I speak to people how limited they feel their political options are. So I was in Germany a month ago, and the migration crisis. People just don't feel like there's anything they can really do about it. Economic globalization, there's really nothing we can do about it. The EU, nobody likes it. We don't really have an alternative. And so there's that feeling that everything that we are facing is a kind of fate for us. And I think that's quite pervasive. I think a lot of the distemper of our political culture in this primary season stems from the fact that two different set of voters and two very different political candidates, Sanders and Trump, are basically telling people, you can do something. The future doesn't have to be today.
Or I can do something. I can control this.
Right.
Yeah.
The future doesn't have to be today plus one.
Yeah.
It could be something different. And that's, I think, is explosive in an environment where people,
reinforces
Mary's point, which is that she made observations about localism and so forth, people wanting to get back to the real, right? Recognizing they don't want to live in an empire of artifice. And then I look at our political distemper, and I see lots of downsides to it, but the upside is we seem to have people who say that we want the future to be a function of our act of collective freedom and not just administered to us. So that's my first observation. My second observation, you really, really, really are opposed to the idea of America as a proposition, an experiment, or an idea, it seems to me. Because that makes the body politic into an artifice. And that seems to be it's so much a part of our language.
Yeah, yeah.
Richard Neuhaus, he loved to talk about the American experiment. I never liked it. I always thought, you know, I'm not patriotic to an experiment. I'm patriotic to a place.
Right.
People.
Right. To home.
Yeah, to
a home. And what's, no, and this is why, I mean, I've actually had to think, you can imagine, in the face of this kind of argument, it doesn't, you know, you get accused of a certain lack of patriotism and of not loving your country. Mm-hmm. But we don't, but it's peculiar, and I think it's peculiarly American, that loving your country means, in particular, loving a particular political philosophy or political system.
People who love ideas are called ideologues.
But I think this is a curious function of our history. I mean, you know, you could be French, for instance, and have a common memory and a common identity that precedes and transcends a variety of antithetical political arrangements, and there's a meaning to that. But the entire meaning of being American, it seems to me, is contained within the.
Can
I push back against myself?
I think Lincoln's mystic chords of memory represent a counterstroke in the American tradition. The mystic chords of memory are not an idea. That refers back to. So I think there's a tension in our public life, and that we unwittingly contribute. By talking about America as an experiment, we unwittingly contribute to what we actually ought to be resisting.
No, I agree with that, and I don't like that language particularly. And there are other countervailing, just in my own background, you know, I come from a place where my family has been in place, not a particularly nice place from the point of view of this side of the country, but in any event, where my family has been in place since about the time of the Civil War, since before the Civil War. And, you know, it's a place in the world that nobody else knows anything about, and it's got all kinds of sort of thick lore and memory, and, you know, I know every bend in the road, and, you know, love it all the more. I mean, it's funny, you know, in America, generally speaking, we don't have a hobbit's patriotism. You know, our love for our home tends not to be, I think for these reasons in part, like the love of the Shire. And I think there are complicated reasons for that. Partly is the peculiarly philosophical character of the country. Part of it is the lack of the common culture. Part of it is the fact that the project of America from sea to shining sea wasn't complete until about the time we had actually a culture industry. And so much of the culture that we have shared in common as a complete people that emerged in the 20th century is itself not organic, but manufactured. All of those things make us quite peculiar, I think. And I would want to reserve a real sense of patriotism as love of patria, home.
So back to, again, reinforce Mary's sort of, there are these counter trends. It seems to me that the controversy about immigration is the question about immigration is the question, what kind of people are we and what kind of people do we want to become? And so when everyone thinks about the nature of that particular political turmoil, I regret very much the terms under which it's being used in the public sphere. But that is a metaphysical question.
Yeah. It is.
And so it's interesting that in Europe and in the United States, so I guess what I'm just sort of saying is the absolutism as absolute? Or does human nature?
No, I mean, well,
reasserting itself.
Human nature obviously has always, it seems to be part of the faith and true, not that those two things are, that nature has its revenge eventually, or, that's a negative way of putting it. Although it does have its revenge, but that in the end, reality is better than all of our theories about it. Our practice tends to be better than all of our theories about it, and therefore, if human beings are what we say they are, that is going to emerge, in spite of itself and in spite of all of the kinds of self-inflicted wounds we impose upon ourselves. So, of course, not to get too metaphysical here, but being, it seems to me, is by its very nature the kind of thing, being by its very nature, it cannot be dominated. And so every absolutism has to be false in the end.
Right.
But it can do a great deal of damage in being false, it seems to me.
Please help me thank Professor Hammond.
Sorry I went on so long.